can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, NA member FDIC. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Pushkin. Imagine there's a place in our world where the known things go. Calculations, weather maps, old barometer readings. Strange weather lately, right? Tragic weather. Catastrophic weather. Snowmageddon. Heat apocalypse. It always makes me think of something attributed to Mark Twain. Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Better check the forecast.
Tonight, a dangerous winter storm is bearing down on the East Coast, with blizzard warnings issued for the New York City area and Boston.
Oh, geez, I hope people will be okay. Might as well catch up on my reading. I've been going through old issues of Poor Richard's Almanac. Let's see. 1753. In the preface, Benjamin Franklin looks back at 20 years of publishing his Poor Richard's Almanacs, and he makes this pretty corny joke about how no matter what weather he predicted day to day, year after year, his prediction was right. At least, he predicted the right weather somewhere in the world. In the 18th century, no one could really predict the weather, not like today.
Tens of millions are in the path of this nor'easter that could bring record snowfall and coastal flooding.
Time to batten down the hatches and then escape over the threshold to a radio booth in New York during another terrible snowstorm more than half a century ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, a good morning to you. This is John Cameron Swayze in the NBC newsroom in New York. Over a good deal of the storm area today, the forecast is for better weather, which is encouraging news to many thousands of people. We'll have details of this top subject during the broadcast.
The great blizzard of 1947 hit New York the day after Christmas. If you were in its path, you likely lost power and couldn't listen to the radio or watch television. Life magazine printed photographs of people skiing through the streets. Movie theaters ran newsreel reports, very much in the style of the newsreel reports from the Second World War, which had only just ended.
Friday, December 26, 1947. It's a black, white Friday in New York City as a snow cloud burst, as it's officially called, dumps 2 inches of snow an hour on the town.
I've always been fascinated by how much weather reporting has in common with war reporting, as if the weather were an enemy to be battled. But so formidable that the weather nearly always wins. This time, the enemy had conducted a sneak attack. New Yorkers were blindsided.
As many as 30,000 cars had to be abandoned by their drivers. It was a $6 million project to make New York's streets passable again. The storm extended from the nation's capital to northern Maine, but it was New York and its suburbs that bore the brunt of the fall. The officially recorded 26 inches was 5 more inches than the historic blizzard of 1888.
For most of human history, people would wake up in the morning, look up in the sky, have a good idea, a reasonable idea, about what the day might bring. But no idea what tomorrow would bring. Today, I look on my phone, I can see the weather anywhere in the world, hour by hour. For the next week, I have an oracle in my back pocket, a tiny god. It's a kind of thing, a form of technology, a type of knowledge, that I tend to put in a category in my head that says, brought to you by NASA, or a product of the space race. And partly that's true. The weather app on my iPhone is a product of war, of all the wars of the 20th century. I'd like to know, what does it mean that I carry around in my back pocket this little instrument of war? What does it mean to have at my fingertips the knowledge of what weather is going to happen next everywhere? How has it changed the world to have this knowledge? To take it for granted, even.
And there was one statistic that will probably stamp 99 million tons of snow fell in New York in 16 hours.
Welcome to The Last Archive, the show about how we know what we know and why it seems lately as if we don't know anything at all. I'm Jill Lepore. This season is all about common knowledge, what everyone knows or thinks they know, knowledge people share in common. This episode, the weather. Everyone's always talking about it, but nobody ever does anything about it. Or do they? It's a big, messy, uncertain world, looking up to the skies, to the heavens, and trying to read in the clouds signs of what might happen next. Snow, rain, a beautiful day. It's an elemental curiosity, but it's also an urgent one. You can see why forecasting the weather is a linchpin of wartime planning. The weather can determine if you live or die, whether your crops fail, your boat sinks, you run out of water, you lose your home in a flood. Then there are the more ordinary matters. Do you need an umbrella today? I love the idea that I can know what's coming next. It's a comfort, but it's also strange, as if we could find such certainty in such an uncertain world. In the U.S., weather records go pretty far back. For centuries, farmers, factory workers, all sorts of ordinary people recorded the weather, little jottings and diaries mostly. People also consulted farmers' almanacs to look for weather predictions there. Something bigger started to happen, though, in the 1840s. A national data collection project headed up by a new national institution, the Smithsonian. I've got a graduate student, Adelaide Mandeville, working on a history dissertation about all of this, and I called her up, and she explained to me what the Smithsonian had been trying to do and how it depended on the telegraph system.
Working with the telegraph companies, they enlist, like 150 volunteers in the first year to start sending in their local weather observations. And then the Smithsonian takes all of that and maps it. And then 1870, I think, they make the first, national weather agency. So that's when it becomes a federal project.
For a long time, that project relied on hundreds, even thousands of volunteers who sent in their local weather observations. And as one meteorologist said in 1879, anyone could do it.
There is one science which is within the grasp of every mind, and which to be successfully cultivated requires no preparation. The science of rain and fine weather, but which now receives the higher title of meteorology.
By the end of the 19th century, experts were taking over. Eventually, the work of predicting the weather moved to the U.S. Signal Service, and then, in 1891, Congress created the Weather Bureau. It was a division of the Department of Agriculture. The chief of this new weather bureau, he didn't just oversee the collection of weather records. He was supposed to forecast storms and droughts and floods, anything that would affect agriculture or industry or commerce. The whole scheme had a kind of citizen science quality to it. The Weather Bureau wanted to make meteorology common knowledge. To teach people about the latest instruments, it installed little weather kiosks in 29 cities. Out there on city sidewalks, there were these boxes with maps and charts, thermometers and barometers. What the Weather Bureau really wanted was for newspapers to print weather maps. But before that happened, the weather report went out in a different way, as Adelaide Mandeville explained to me.
The post office in the early 20th century. They were responsible for delivering weather forecasts with the mail. But there was an issue because they would go out at 7 a.m. That's when the mail was delivered, and the forecast each day, new information came in at 10 a.m. So it was always a little delayed, and the weather forecaster sort of got a reputation for not being super accurate. But then they had these, you know, really, really helpful and important forecasts where they warned towns that there was going to be a huge flood or a hurricane and people were able to evacuate.
Then, once radio started in the 1920s, you could hear the weather forecast over the wireless.
The city of Newark, we give you the daily weather report. A wind blowing 18 miles per hour from the northwest. A temperature of 38 degrees, which means reading different
maps. Forecasting had by now gotten more accurate than it had ever been before. That's because of advances made just before the First World War, when a Norwegian meteorologist recorded the weather across Europe. Then during the war, his son, working for the military, discovered the nature of the movement of masses of cold and warm air. He called these fronts, like battle fronts, except the weather. An English mathematician, also involved in the war effort, used their data and those ideas to devise a mathematical model to predict the weather. Unfortunately, it didn't work. Still, the idea took hold that there should be a model, and that if only you could do the calculations fast enough, you could predict the weather. So, right, doing that got a lot easier after computers were invented.
And here's the latest weather report.
Nothing advances science like war. During the Second World War, those mathematical models got better and better. And by the end of the war, you could use computers to run those calculations. So finally, you could make your predictions faster than the speed of weather. If you could get ahead of the storm, you could get ahead of the enemy.
Weather forecasting becomes critical to military strategy during the war, and they're developing these new technologies to assist them in doing that. So like radar and these aircraft controls and, you know, more extensive data collection systems, and all of that does make them better at forecasting.
By 1947, Americans had gotten used to the idea that, especially if there were a really big storm coming, they'd know it in advance.
Nearly 26 inches have fallen, a record unequaled in the annals of the Weather Bureau.
But really, it wasn't the scale of that storm that was the strangest thing about it. The strangest thing about it was that it was so unexpected.
When you wake up in the morning and you open up an eye, you turn from the clock and you look to the sky. What's the weather doing? Is it wet or dry? Who knows? What's the weatherman?
And here's the latest weather report. Extreme cold. Temperature below zero.
In the 1950s, when Americans started buying televisions in real numbers, they could flip a switch and hear a forecast. Sometimes a goofy one. A lot of early TV forecasts came in the form of cartoons. Some of them involved puppets. One was sponsored by Botany Neckties and featured a little woolly lamb. No recordings of the song exist, so we found the lyrics and made our own.
It's hot, it's cold, it's rain, it's fair, it's all mixed up together. But I, as Botany's little lamb, predict tomorrow's weather.
I love how silly these early weather reports were, but this goofiness didn't last long. Pretty quickly in those post-war years, television weather forecasting left lambs behind and settled into the style we still have today.
Weather today, Montana in a real state of deep freeze, about 48 degrees near Helena, stormy along the Gulf of Mexico and Texas.
A sober-looking fellow in a suit and tie, part sportscaster, part scientist.
Generally, however, here in New York and out in Chicago, something resembling springtime, 58 degrees here in New York this afternoon. It's really a pretty big country after all. Lots of weather and lots of news.
The buttoned-up weatherman and his straight-up forecast? This was a wartime offshoot, products of the Army and the Navy. The earliest national television weather forecast was made by a fellow who had had training in meteorology during the war. A lot of soldiers and sailors had gotten that kind of training. And when you look at it, even today, a modern weather report, the map, the pointer, the symbols, the presentation, it's like a military briefing, right?
Oh, let me get the Weather Bureau here. We sent the weather. James, are you there?
In 1952, NBC launched The Today Show.
U.S. weather forecast, do you understand? Right in the Weather Bureau, where they make the stuff. When we're ready for you, go ahead, Jim. I'll put it on the map.
The Today Show's anchor, Dave Garraway, in suit and bow tie, is on the phone with a guy from the Weather Bureau. He's in a studio kitted out with all kinds of gimcrackery. A giant telephone, a microphone the size of a broomstick hanging down his front, a bank of blinking television monitors. Very high-tech, 1950s style. But then, the telephone in one hand, he's got a piece of chalk in his other hand, and he starts writing the weather on a big chalkboard with a map of the country drawn on it.
Here it turns to rain in Pennsylvania. About 32 up here, freezing drizzle.
He's not God, this guy, but here he is every morning, telling you what your day will be like, and for the most part, earning your trust. I think, having lived through some of this era, there was also something so seemingly simple about it. You get the weather report in the morning, you put on your windbreaker, you head out expecting rain. You get on with your day. There was a Cold War going on. The world might end in a blink, an atomic bomb, the end of life on Earth. But hey, you knew enough at least that you needed a windbreaker today.
I want you to know your forecast is very good because it's raining right here in New York.
All those long years of the Cold War, though, the 1950s, the 1960s, there was something else going on. For one thing, the weather forecasting was pretty good, reliable, useful, but it had stopped getting much better. Each war, the First World War, the Second World War, the Cold War, had advanced the science of meteorology. But weather as folklore, proverbs, that goofiness that started with Poor Richard's Almanac, went down to the Singing Lamb, that was still around too, in a way. You can see it in one little town in America, in 1970.
Well, good morning, everyone. Time once again for the KRSB Mount Nebo Goat Report, the official goat report for Roseburg.
Yes, you heard that right. The Mount Nebo Goat Report. In the city of Roseburg, Oregon. They went old school. The local news started issuing forecasts by reporting on the position of a herd of goats up on a mountain outside town, Mount Nebo. And I know this sounds crazy, but you really can use sheep and goats to predict the weather. They're pretty accurate. There's no end of proverbs about this phenomenon. When sheep gather in a huddle, tomorrow we'll have a puddle. That's true. And so, the KRSB Mount Nebo Goat Report.
Goat rise came this morning at about 6:30 a.m., and at the moment we have somewhat scattered goats under an intense high goat pressure system. The goats are ranging this morning about mid-mountain, three-quarters of the way up Mount Nebo. Thus, we will have a beautiful June morning once again.
What I think is going on here is a kind of back-to-nature vibe. But there's something else here, too, an anti-war vibe, the idea that maybe the weather isn't brought to you by the military. Maybe the weather isn't the enemy. Maybe the weather could also just be goats up on a hill. Then, too, there's a sense here of the chaos of climate. By the 1970s, meteorologists were talking about the butterfly effect, the idea that a butterfly flapping its wings in one part of the world could have an effect on a weather system on the other side of the world. That wasn't really a new idea in the 1970s. It had first appeared in a meteorology journal in 1918 during the First World War about a different insect. A grasshopper in Idaho might conceivably initiate a storm movement which would sweep across the continent and destroy New York City. It was a very scary thought. It got much scarier somehow in the 1970s, in the middle of the Vietnam War. The weather is chaos. It's complicated, so formidably intricate, a set of innumerable forces intersecting in infinite ways. The system can never be reduced to any mathematical model. Not perfectly, anyway. But what if we didn't have to understand all that complexity? What if instead of trying to model or predict the weather, we could just control it? That story, after the break.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
This is an airport weather station. Here, with their charts and their instruments, men try to predict tomorrow's weather. Quite often, they succeed.
In 1958, CBS News reported on the latest research in the field of meteorology.
The fact is that we don't know very much about the forces that create the weather. Therefore, we can't always predict with accuracy. Consider some of the things we don't know. Consider this cloud.
The Cold War, the age of the atomic bomb, had given rise to a revolution in atmospheric sciences. And still, no one really understood the workings of weather. What exactly produces high winds, a hurricane, a tornado, a blizzard? Was it a butterfly on the other side of the world? What causes rain? How do clouds form? At the time, the field was on the verge of a major breakthrough in the work of a scientist named Joanne Malkus. CBS featured her research in its look at the latest goings-on in meteorology.
Dr. Malkus is studying a tiny but very important part of weather, a cloud.
Joanne Malkus, better known by a later married name, Joanne Simpson, was the first woman in the United States to earn a PhD in meteorology. Her whole career came out of the Second World War.
She was always interested in flying and sailing and math, but didn't really have an interest in science until she went to University of Chicago. And then she describes her interest in meteorology as an accident of World War II. And she starts college in 1940, and then Pearl Harbor happens. And she says her whole world's in flames, and she really wants to contribute to the war effort.
That's Adelaide Mandeville again. Simpson's father had been a reporter covering aviation. Her mother, a birth control activist.
Her parents won't let her join the military and say you have to stay in college. And so she finds this aviation training program, World War II training program at University of Chicago that was started by this meteorologist named Carl Gustav Rossby, who many people consider like the greatest meteorologist of the 20th century.
If you've ever flown on an airplane, you can thank Carl Gustav Rossby. He was key in identifying the jet stream. He explained how atmospheric circulation of the weather works like waves. He was Simpson's advisor. He was a great meteorologist. Apparently, he was not a great person.
He was really dismissive of her and her work. He's like, clouds are completely insignificant. They just don't matter. You as a girl and clouds as passive and insignificant are a perfect match. She's like, okay, sir, and moves on to a new advisor and continues working on it.
In spite of that, Simpson persevered. She finished her dissertation in 1949. She saw something few other meteorologists had seen, that clouds weren't insignificant and that they were important to weather in all kinds of ways, that they were worth investigating. It's almost as though, as a person whose own power had been invisible to a lot of people, including her advisor, she could see the power in something that looked like fluff. Here's Simpson in that 1958 CBS News story.
If we could understand what's happening in this coffee cup, we could begin to learn about clouds. There's heat and moisture in the coffee cup. Because hot air rises, we find motions.
When I first watched this interview with Simpson, it drove me crazy that this important scientist has to introduce an idea using a coffee mug. I guess because she's a woman. But then it turns out it's a really good explanation.
The steam coming up from the cup is water vapor, which is being condensed out into a lot of tiny little liquid water droplets. Something very similar to this is happening over the tropical oceans.
Simpson spent much of her career flying through clouds and airplanes with cameras strapped to the nose, recording movements and taking measurements.
As a marine meteorologist, I began to wonder about clouds. How do clouds grow? Where do they get the energy to feed on? To find out, we have to go to the places where the clouds are. We have to chase after them in the sky.
So she's up there in airplanes, chasing clouds, making films, analyzing those films frame by frame, and building a mathematical model of the behavior of clouds. To do all those things, she needs what was at the time really expensive technology. And the best way to get access to that technology was through the military, which had long had a huge interest in understanding and predicting the weather. By the 1950s, at the beginning of the Cold War, what the U.S. military would really, really like is to be able to control the weather. This is what Adelaide Mandeville's research is all about. Earlier scientists had wanted to understand things. Cold War era scientists wanted to control things. Mind control, riot control, pain control, weather control.
We can fully harness nature. And so, you know, we're one step closer to being able to move clouds and make it rain and turn a hurricane in a different direction, mitigate lightning so forest fires don't happen. They start coming up with all these ideas, turning deserts into gardens.
And you know, why not? Because meanwhile, a bunch of other wartime technologies were making it possible to control the weather indoors.
Enclosures everywhere are today benefiting by weather made to order by Carrier. Instead of traveling away from business and home to seek relief, you can obtain this same comfort right in your own home or office through air conditioning.
And so we can control the weather inside.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could just touch a button and fill your home with warm spring sunlight? Now you can have electric heating, the next best thing to sunshine.
Next, we'll control the weather outside.
Air conditioning, electric heating, indoor weather control. For the outdoors, the equivalent was a discovery made in 1946 by three scientists at General Electric. They called it cloud seeding, dropping dry ice from airplanes onto clouds to make them rain, weather to order.
Cloud seeding then completely takes off and just becomes this national obsession. A lot of veterans from the war who have learned to fly and have a general sense of weather patterns, they start doing it and selling their services to farmers who are facing drought, to mayors who, you know, need to refill their public water supply, to Native American tribes who have done their annual rainmaking ceremonies and didn't work that year. And so they hired these rainmakers. Then it tumbles into the Cold War period and just explodes.
Suddenly, the idea of controlling the weather seems so promising. You can force clouds to rain. You can't really control how much or what the consequences will be, but in a crude way, it does work. In 1951, Congress debated the Weather Modification Act, providing for equitable distribution of precipitation among the states. Think about that for a minute. The confidence. We are talking about drafting legislation to ensure equal rainfall between the states. And you thought my tree branch idea was screwy. In 1953, Congress established a National Weather Modification Commission, as if you could jump from cloud seeding to setting the temperature every day, like with a thermostat in your living room. Meanwhile, the military is awfully interested in the secret stuff, weather as a weapon. Think of the advantages that would have brought in a war if you could control the weather in your enemy's territory. So it's just at this point in the middle of the 1950s that Joanne Simpson has started to revolutionize the study of clouds. She's an experimental scientist doing basic research, but she sure as hell can't do it alone. So she got funding any way she could from any branch of the military. And if she had to say, oh yeah, this has a military application, she'd say it.
Simpson is looking for projects that will let her do cloud seeding so that she can test her models.
But the way Simpson talks about her work, at least in public, it's always about basic research.
These clouds we're passing have a very short life. They're born, they grow, and they die.
It's quite moving, the way she describes clouds. I find it moving. You're almost there with her, chasing them in the sky, like UFOs or aliens.
Then we get a monster runaway cloud. It, too, started as a small, tiny, fleecy thing, or a group of tiny, fleecy things. But then something permitted it to build and grow and defy its cool, dry surroundings. Once we find out what that something is, that takes and breaks off clouds and permits the runaway growth of large numbers of them, well, then perhaps we'll have put in one more link in the long chain of what forms and maintains a hurricane.
Ultimately, she develops the first ever cloud model and the first ever hurricane model. So her work becomes foundational to the next, up until now, 60, 70 years of atmospheric sciences. But in the mid-1950s, she starts working in weather control.
By then, the idea of weather control had gone so entirely mainstream that even President Lyndon B. Johnson was talking about it.
He who controls the weather will control the world.
He who controls the weather will control the world. LBJ. Sounding like a James Bond supervillain. It was such a good line that a screenwriter stole it a couple of years later for a film that was a spoof of a Bond movie. It's called Our Man Flint, and I've got to play some of it for you. In this scene, a U.S. general complains about the supervillain's evil plan.
Turn wheat belts into deserts. Put icebergs in the Mediterranean. You control the weather and you control the world.
If you could control the weather, you could also do something seemingly incredibly useful. You could weaken hurricanes before they hit land.
In the mid-1950s, there's a series of hurricanes that cause massive amounts of damage. Hundreds of people die. And the government starts the National Hurricane Research Project. And one of the methods they use to research hurricanes is cloud seeding.
Joanne Simpson served as top advisor to what comes to be called Project Storm Fury, using cloud seeding to modify a hurricane. But a hitch with trying to modify a hurricane is you first have to wait for one to happen. So in the meantime, Simpson and her team decided to run tests on promising storm clouds.
Now it's summer of 1963, and they're in Puerto Rico at a U.S. naval base. And they go up, and she chooses 10 clouds near San Juan, and they seed them. And then they're waiting to see what happens. And the first cloud, in Simpson's telling, just balloons. It grows and grows.
They think they're watching cloud seeding work, And they do end up seeding a hurricane that same year. They publish a big paper about it. It gets a lot of press attention. Then, 2 years later, in 1965, when Simpson is serving as director of Storm Fury, they decided to try to modify another hurricane named Betsy off the coast of Puerto Rico. They announced that plan to the press.
Dawn, August 27th. At Florida and island bases, Navy, Weather Bureau, and Air Force planes are warming up to their daily task.
Except at the last minute, the hurricane changed course.
Suddenly, on Sunday night, Betsy runs head-on into a high-pressure ridge. Then it turns toward the mainland. Hurricane flags are flying now from Key West to Cape Kennedy.
Because of the course change, the Storm Fury scientists called off their plan to try to modify the hurricane. And then, when Betsy hit Florida and Louisiana, it killed 80 people.
Fatality list is as follows. 25-year-old Mrs. Ann Mayu, her body was found in the Franklin Avenue ditch. She was swept away by floodwaters.
Floridians were furious. A lot of them blamed Project Storm Fury, thought the scientists had made the hurricane so severe. In truth, Storm Fury wasn't responsible. The scientists had already abandoned the project, but people still blamed them. Simpson resigned. What really spelled the end of this kind of weather modification, though, were experiments going on at the same time, but very far away.
So they were using cloud seeding to disrupt flight patterns, or to try to do this, disrupt flight patterns to flood the Ho Chi Minh Trail so that they couldn't get supplies where they needed to go.
During the Vietnam War, the U.S. government spent more than $20 million on this project, with few conclusive results. Much of the story didn't come out until the Pentagon Papers were leaked in 1971.
They don't admit to using it until 1974. There's huge public backlash.
The backlash against weather control was because it was associated with the many atrocities committed by scientists in Vietnam, Agent Orange, napalm. Years later, Simpson talked about this in an interview.
I thought it was terrible. I mean, all my life I've tried to work for the betterment of the planet and the people, even in a small way, and then to use what I've done as some kind of a military thing, I obviously am very concerned and not happy about it.
Simpson had gotten involved in this research because of Pearl Harbor. She'd gotten pretty much all her funding from the U.S. military during the Cold War. And then, after the Vietnam War is revealed to have been a series of frauds and lies and atrocities, she is shocked to discover that her research has been used to try to make it rain on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I'm just not buying it. I can't look inside Joanne Simpson's heart, though, any better than I can see into a cloud. But I do know this. The revolution in atmospheric science that started during the Second World War came crashing down in the 1970s, in the aftermath of Vietnam. It wasn't only Vietnam that led to this turning point. It was also rising concern about another kind of weather modification, climate change. It turned out people were not controlling the weather, making it better, making it easier for farmers to grow, averting droughts and hurricanes and bad storms and heat waves. Instead, people were making the weather worse.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, NA member FDIC, Copyright 2024. JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
In 1982, the Weather Channel began broadcasting weather forecasts nonstop. Soon, private weather forecasting became big business.
From Atlanta, Georgia, home of the new Weather Channel Network, this is the official inaugural program of cable television's newest 24-hour live network, the Weather Channel.
It wasn't only the Weather Channel. There were dedicated weather reporting services you could subscribe to, like AccuWeather. And in the 1990s, once people were able to use the internet, they found new ways to obsess about the weather, to make money off of it, to seek out the latest up-to-date forecast minute by minute, accuracy promised. It was as if, merely by updating your weather report every second, you could imagine that you were somehow in control, prevailing over the enemy. But to sell a forecast as an illusion of control, you have to sell people the idea that the weather is out of control. TV weather reports trying to compete with online services got zanier. The weatherman was no longer calm and detached. The weatherman started panicking.
I'm AccuWeather.com meteorologist Jim Kosick. Our paralyzing, crippling, record-breaking storm comes today!
That was a forecast for a snowstorm in 2010. Like, not the end of the world, a snowstorm. You think you've heard the hypiest hype, and then along comes hypier hype. In 1997, meteorologists called a storm the climate event of the century. Post-9/11, weather reports for the era of the global war on terror, they had to start inventing new nouns.
Some call it Snowmageddon, others Snowpocalypse.
It was a forecasting arms race for the war on terror, because, of course, it was also a ratings race. In 2006, the Weather Channel, trying to keep up, launched a series called It Could Happen Tomorrow, featuring imaginary disasters.
One day, the fog clears, and the city by the bay is changed forever. One day, traffic stops, and the city that never sleeps stands still. It hasn't happened yet, but it could happen tomorrow. Sunday night on the Weather Channel, witness unbelievable acts of nature that could devastate our city.
Forecasting never lost its military posture, its wartime element. With a weather app on your phone, you carry around with you an instrument of war that earlier generations could only dream of. War approaches. Soldier, you are prepared. And still, it seems, the enemy is gaining.
In Pakistan, the government says floods across the country have now killed more than 1,300 people.
Britain's hottest day ever recorded, with high temperatures potentially reaching at least 103 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not just above normal, that is 30 degrees above normal.
A record-breaking drought, the longest and most severe drought in recent history. China's largest river, Yangtze, has dried up.
We are getting a frightening look at this image of Hurricane Ida as she bears down on the Gulf Coast. Those outer bands whipping the area for hours overnight.
It's not just the weather, of course. It's the climate. Climate is a pattern of weather, the typical weather in a particular place. Like, if we were talking about a person, your mood on any given day would be like the weather. On Tuesday, you're sad. But your temperament, your disposition, you're generally cheerful. That would be like the climate. The weather is having many more bad days because the climate is getting worse, more extreme. As global temperatures warm, the weather's getting less predictable. A Stanford study argues that the hotter the climate becomes, the less predictable the weather will be. That sense that you could know what's coming next, that might soon become a thing of the past.
The weather situation remains extremely rugged. The entire state declared under a state of emergency by Governor Dukakis.
When I was a kid, 11 years old, New England was hit with what everyone got to be calling the Blizzard of 1978. It was the first time the local television stations ran continuous weather coverage, nonstop, for days. The kind of coverage that inspired the start of the Weather Channel. You'd look out the window, the blizzard. You'd turn on the TV, the blizzard.
Snow-battered Boston is in the middle of the worst winter storm it's probably ever seen, and it's not over yet. The full fury of the winter blast is still with us. It's going to be all day, according to the latest word from the United States Weather Bureau.
I've never forgotten this storm. I went to school that first day, a Monday. My parents went to work. Weather forecasting in the 1970s was already so hyped up and hyperbolic that a lot of people just ignored the forecast of a winter storm. Then everyone got sent home. I remember riding on the school bus, not certain we'd make it through the snow.
We've asked everyone to open their homes so that if there are any stranded motorists nearby, they may have refuge.
The snow only fell for 2 days, but people were trapped for a lot longer. Winds blew snowdrifts 15 feet high. Hundreds of thousands of people lost power. In Massachusetts alone, 11,000 homes were destroyed.
Coming in at the moment, further word from Boston Edison. Particularly, it's not good. Uh-oh. We were hoping, from a report we had earlier, that we would get power back.
People everywhere tried to help out. Rescue workers, homemakers, anyone. Movie theaters stayed open as shelters.
Do they have to pay to get in?
No, free admission.
Free admission. Now, these people, just people stranded in the area.
Right. We're taking them all up there, same shelter for them. Like I said, the Red Cross is up there with Red Cross.
It can be numbing, talking about the weather and climate change. But then I think about why I'm so haunted by the blizzard of 1978. In a town nearby, a boy about my age had gone missing. Every day, the radio gave updates on the search for him. That day, we'd got sent home from school. He'd gone out to play in the snow, and he never came in. The whole neighborhood, half the town, was out in the blizzard for hours looking for this boy. They didn't find his long-dead body until well after it was all over, his mitten sticking up from the melting snow. He tried to get back inside, fell over, just got buried under it. It was falling so fast. It's not some idle interest wanting to predict the weather. It's life or death. And it's not crazy wanting to control it. We are bags of water and bone, vulnerable to every wind, drought, heat wave, and rainstorm. But under the fury of each snowpocalypse lies a certain salvation in bearing witness to our common frailty and in the helping, the rescuing, the fortifying one another against the storm, something the best weather-beaten newscasters know. At the height of the storm, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis appeared on television, not in a suit and tie, but in a sweater, looking strained and exhausted. You see the weathermen, too, shaking, shuddering with the knowledge of it, even as storms come to an end.
All our efforts to control our environment must inevitably fall short.
We've learned that society is a pretty recent experiment, that Commonwealth Avenue at 5 a.m. on the morning of a blizzard with a power blackout can be frightening. But we've also learned that what we mostly do is help each other out. We went on living quietly, looking in on the neighbor just in case. I think it was a good moment. And I think that's something to remember. Till the next time.
And I do try to remember that. And I have more occasion every year. Because the blizzards are getting worse. Because the climate is changing. 9 of Boston's 10 worst on record snowstorms have happened since 1978. 6 of them since 2003. 2010 was Snowmageddon. 2016, Snowzilla. Happening today, somewhere near you, we are all going through one big ongoing storm, hunkered down, but also poking out to see who needs help most. And there's still time, pulled together by our panic, to dig out from this storm. The Last Archive is written and hosted by me, Jill Lepore. It's produced by Sophie Crane, Ben Nadafhafri, and Lucy Sullivan. Our editors are Julia Barton and Sophie Crane, and our executive producer is Mia Lobel. Jake Gorski is our engineer. Fact-checking by Amy Gaines. Original music by Matthias Bossi and John Evans of Stellwagen Symphonette. Our foolproof player is Robert Ricotta. Many of our sound effects are from Harry Jeanette Jr. and the Star Jeanette Foundation. The Last Archive is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus, offering bonus content like The Last Archivist, a limited series just for subscribers, and ad-free listening across our network for $4.99 a month. Look for the Pushkin Plus channel on Apple Podcasts or at pushkin.fm. If you like the show, please remember to rate, share, and review. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jill Lepore.
Hey, it's Ben. Did you know you can listen to The Last Archive on Amazon Music? And you can stream your favorite albums and artists in the app, so you can do all of your listening in one place. Plus, Amazon Prime members get access to ad-free podcasts from other podcast networks like Wondery and Amazon exclusive shows. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or just ask your Alexa device to play The Last Archive on Amazon Music.